And welcome back. Charles Lindbergh, the famed aviator who became the first man to fly the Atlantic solo, was born 113 years ago today. The name Lindbergh is prominent in St. Louis, and St. Louis is prominent in his history as well. His historic plane, of course, was the Spirit of St. Louis. His landmark 1927 journey came after young Lindbergh had literally bounced around the Midwest as a barnstorming aviator and airmail pilot. We thought we'd acknowledge Lucky Lindy and a St. Louis connection on this birthday. Joining me in studio is Sharon Smith, the curator of civic and personal identity at the Missouri History Museum. With us by phone is St. Louis Public Radio's man in Washington, Jim Howard. Jim has been immersed in one aspect of the Lindbergh story of late. Jim, nice to have you with us, and what have you been up to?
Well, it's sort of an adult version of a field trip, I guess I would put it. Any reason to get out of the Capitol building and go do some exploring at the Smithsonian is always a good day out. And last week I had the chance to talk to two of the officials that are overseeing rather significant preservation work on the Spirit of St. Louis. The plane is now on the floor inside the main lobby in the Milestones of Flight Gallery, where you can walk literally within just 2 to 3 feet of the nose cone. It's behind a fence, but it's a chance to see it much closer than you otherwise would see it.
Well, I've seen it, and I was surprised at how small it is. And to think of taking a trip across the Atlantic and something like that was really quite daunting.
Yeah, if you think about the size of the ocean and all of the peril that was involved, you know, clearly Lindbergh had the right idea with making this essentially a flying fuel tank, so much so that he didn't even have a front-facing windshield. He had to use a periscope out the left side of the plane. But he had three windows, one to the left, one to the right, and one above him. But flying across the Atlantic at that point, there really probably wasn't much to see until he got over land, and he could do everything that way. But the objective was to get from land to land and not, unfortunately, stop anywhere in the middle.
Well, yeah, of course, the plane has not been flying of late. What sort of restoration or repairs are necessary? It's just been hanging from a ceiling.
Well, most of the plane is covered in fabric. A lot of people get the idea because of the color of the plane. Now, the color has changed slightly over the years because of chemical changes in what's on the surface. But most of the plane is made of cotton fabric, except the engine area and the cowling around the engine and the supports for the fuel tanks and the framing itself. Most of the skin of the aircraft and the wings is a cotton material painted or soaked in what's a cellulose nitrate dope mixed with aluminum powder, which gives it that appearance. Anybody that used to do model airplaning and make their own planes and stuff would use the same kind of dope material. It shrinks the fabric and tightens it around the frame. It makes it waterproof. It's a form of one of the very earliest plastics known, and which is why they used it for this construction. The problem is cellulose nitrate dope. The cellulose nitrate is also very susceptible to light degradation, and what it does is it degrades and it shrinks. Imagine your clothing constantly getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And essentially what's happening is the fibers in the cotton fabric are being strained by this chemical tightening and shrinking and causing little tears. And we're talking an 88-year-old plane, a 90-year-old plane. One fun element here is the fuselage, the area from behind the two doors all the way back to the tail. While the material dates to 1927, it was not on the plane when he left New York. The French put it on after French individuals greeting him at La Bourget airfield actually tore little holes in the fabric that was there. The French Air Force was apparently embarrassed, went in and recovered it with French linen. So part of it's cotton, part of it's linen. But it's all very old, and it's all under the same stresses of nature and time.
Well, I have to tell you that Sharon Smith and I are sitting here and both kind of rolling our eyes when you talk about the feeling of what's it like when your clothes are getting a little tighter? I think we all have some sense of that. Sharon, let me turn to you because the Missouri History Museum also has possession of a plane. It is not the Spirit of St. Louis, but it is a Lindbergh plane. What's that all about?
Well, in reference to the one that Jim is talking about, we do have a sister of the monocoupe, the Ryan monocoupe, which is one of the planes that was used in the movie The Spirit of St. Louis with Jimmy Stewart. And so that one hangs in the Grand Hall of the History Museum in St. Louis. And then we also have a plane that belonged to Charles Lindbergh that he had specially made in St. Louis with the monocoupe company that is another airplane that now hangs at the Lambert International Airport. So we do have two that are sort of related to Lindbergh, one more so than the other.
How is it that the Missouri History Museum has so many artifacts and memorabilia from Charles Lindbergh?
Well, you know, we're real fortunate to have those and to be known as the repository for all of the many gifts that were given to Charles and then ultimately Charles and Anne over their many flights. You know, and I think part of that is the wonderful spirit that the first curator had, which was Nettie Beauregard, who went to Charles Lindbergh and said, hey, can we borrow these items for about 10 days and show them off here in St. Louis? Since really you left from here, many St. Louisans would think that that's where the flight started. And over those 10 days, we had so many people that came to look at them that Charles kept extending that loan and extending the loan until finally in the 1930s, he and Anne made all of those items gifts to the Missouri History Museum. And we still have those today, and we're very, very lucky to have them.
But not so much on display today as they have been in the past.
That's correct. We recently took that exhibit down a couple years ago, but those gifts, many people who have lived all of their life in St. Louis would remember coming to the Jefferson Memorial, as it was known in the day, and see all of the Lindbergh trophies. And so for the moment, they're not on display, other than the flight suit, which is still on display in the 250 exhibit, where we proudly show that as one of the 50 people. Lindbergh is one of our 50 people that we recognize for the birthday.
Jim Howard, I heard your piece this morning that aired during Morning Edition. And, of course, you made much of the fact that the plane is named the Spirit of St. Louis. One of the things I've learned since then is that this was a stipulation that financiers of that flight had. If we're going to give you the money, you're going to name the plane the Spirit of St. Louis. Had you heard that before?
I had not. This is the first time, but sounds like a good business practice. We see that sort of carried through to today with architecture and naming rights and companies that move into big cities and say, we'll do this, but we want naming rights. So probably the closest Midwestern case in point is what used to be the Sears Tower is now the Willis Tower in Chicago. So that just a hat tip to the businessmen at the time that did it.
Sharon, have you heard that?
Yes, I had. And, you know, there was some conversation between Lindbergh and the backers, and certainly it made the most sense to all of them to have St. Louis be on the plane.
Jim, you also had the opportunity to talk to Lindbergh's daughter.
I talked to Reeve Lindbergh. She's a wonderful individual to talk to. She's a terrific author, and anybody that knows her work or her mom's work has seen, you know, how she's dealt with a whole bunch of issues that just didn't fit into today's story. But probably the most surprising thing that I got from her, it was a great conversation Sunday morning. She talked about how her dad, she talked about how her dad really did not participate or want to be part of the big anniversaries. But the glimpse that was fun to get was she talked about the extent he went to go and visit his plane, wearing glasses that he didn't need, putting on a fedora, pinstripe suit that he apparently didn't wear frequently, and would let the curators at the Smithsonian, when it was at the Arts and Industries building, know that he was going to come in and visit, but he would do so very quietly. She said it was not hard at all for him to go unrecognized. She had traveled with him many times as a young child and as a teen, and people didn't recognize him. And she said he just would go frequently and want to, as she put it, hang out with the plane. He just wanted to be near the plane, which I thought was a very interesting insight. It also gives you an idea as to the name of his first book on the flight, which was simply called We, meaning him and the plane.
Sharon, what's the word I'm looking for? His quest for solitude or anonymity during the visits to the plane is something that he couldn't possibly hope to achieve right after that flight. The reaction around the world was incredible, wasn't it?
It was. And you can see that with that collection that we own that just shows the gifts that were sent from all parts of the world, from, you know, upper class, the heads of state, to the, you know, the people who were crocheting pieces for him and sending them to him. It was truly a hero's reception in every stretch of the imagination, and everywhere he went, gifts were given to him. So, I don't know how he ever managed to go anywhere without being seen. He would also come to the History Museum in St. Louis and look at the collection, similarly to the way Jim described his visits to the plane. He would come often at hours when the museum wasn't open so that he could kind of look at his stuff.
And Jim, of course, when the flight to Paris was over, he continued to travel. And part of what came of that were a number of national flags that were painted on the plane, correct?
Right. When he had originally planned to stay in Europe for a while, had no particular itinerary, in great comments that he made on June 11th at the Navy Yard in Washington after he came back aboard the USS Memphis. He had, in fact, drew a lot of laughs from the crowd that assembled. We found some great old NBC audio. A little piece was in the clip this morning. But he said that he really had hoped to stay there for a while. He had only been abroad for the first time and only been out for 2 days. But President Coolidge wanted him back. The world wanted his attention, and he came back. And at the time, before his flight, a member of the Guggenheim family had said, you know, look me up when you get back, initially thinking he wouldn't get back. Lindbergh got back. The Guggenheim family paid for a three-month tour of the United States to promote commercial aviation. Those were comments that Lindbergh made when he first got back to the U.S. in Washington, saying that what the country needed, in addition to its envious airmail system, that Europe was so much further ahead on commercial flight, but they didn't have the same airmail system. And he looked at the issue of subsidies by the government, said that's not the way to go. We should develop this privately, but we need airports first. And one of the things Reid Lindbergh got into was when Charles went out and did this three-month tour of the U.S., that everybody wanted to ask him about his eligibility as a bachelor. He had not yet met his wife, who was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador in Mexico. That would come on the next trip. But they always wanted to know what he wanted to eat, whether he's available, et cetera, and he wanted to talk about commercial aviation. When that tour finished, the U.S. government asked if he would do a goodwill tour through Central and South America, at least the northern portion of South America, come back to Cuba. And a number of places along the way, individuals used locally sourced paint to draw these or paint these small flags on the engine cowling. That is a pretty intense subject of the preservation work going on. That paint is now starting to crack and shrink and fall off the plane. And the debate for them is, do you touch it up? And in the words of the curator, Bob Vanderlinden, you touch it up and make it look shiny and new, in which case it's fake, it's not the original plane or representation, or do you let it fall apart? They have tools and materials that they can use to do some corrections that can later be uncorrected, if I can put it that way, where they're not actually damaging the original material. But there is a fair amount of history that's literally just sort of disintegrating as you see it from the balcony or now up close.
That's a shame. I want to point out to our listeners, by the way, that the online version of your story is online right now at stlpublicradio.org. I haven't seen it yet, but I understand there are a lot of really good pictures that are associated with that as well. So folks can go to stlpublicradio.org. Sharon, is that Lindbergh's legacy, his advocacy for commercial aviation?
I think that certainly was early on. You know, when you look at Lindbergh as an older gentleman, though, you know, he kind of switches gears just a bit. And one of the favorite quotes that I have in my mind from studying some of what he thought of later in life was that, you know, he looks back at technology and he would say, you know, if I had it to do over, I'd rather have birds than airplanes. You know, there's this business of, he kind of went into the whole notion of conservation and more of a sustainability of life and looked at conservation more than aviation and technology. Not that he ever thought that was a bad thing, but I think he kind of grew up but in the process had spent much of his life promoting this notion of aviation and ways that we could make the world smaller, really, by being able to cross the ocean. Kids today think, well, that's nothing new. I mean, you know, we can do that. And they don't get the impact that Lindbergh really made on the whole notion of aviation and how important it was for him to make that first leap across the Atlantic. And from there, you know, really the rest is history. And so he found ways then, he and Anne together even, promoting aviation, you know, within our own country and then abroad by mapping routes that made sense. And so, yeah, I think that really is his legacy.
And his reputation has survived a dark side as well. I mean, there was this whole period of advocacy for isolationism, a little bit too cozy with Adolf Hitler, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Later, subsequent years determined that he had a number of mistresses in Europe and a number of children there. He survived that as in terms of his reputation.
I think so. You know, one of the things that whenever I'm doing tours, I often will say of Lindbergh that he's just a very paradoxical person. You know, he's very complex in all of the things that he was a part of. But, you know, and yeah, his pedestal crumbled for a bit there in the 30s with isolationism and the whole business with, you know, talking about the Jewish population in ways that he did. But he comes back then by sort of shrinking into the background through World War II. He fights as a civilian and helps the Pacific troops in that way. And, you know, he comes out then just kind of wanting to be in solitude. I think he's done with the press and done with fame. And
Jim, I'm sure this is not anything you got into in talking with his daughter.
Actually, we did. It was a hard choice as to what to put in, what to leave out, and I chose to go in the direction of following what I saw as a natural arc of his push behind commercial aviation, what aviation has done to the Earth, how he transitioned to the conservation issues, and how he taught individuals to fly to do air monitoring of poaching, and what's now happening with the Lindbergh Foundation and what their effort is to fight poaching. But we did talk about this, and Reeve handles it very matter-of-factly. She says, you know, in terms of the language of what took place in isolationism before the attack on Pearl Harbor, which is when he changed his position, but the Roosevelt administration just thought he was too hot at the time to touch and wouldn't let him back into the services. President Eisenhower ultimately did. But she also said some of that was the language of the day. It was unfortunate she didn't defend it. She's met the children of the other relationships and describes a very similar parenting kind of here and then gone kind of an arrangement. He always seemed to be trying to get away from places and get to places and not staying anywhere very long, either in flight or with his families. But we did talk about it. It was just it didn't really fit into the piece this morning.
And I guess what it does show in to a certain degree is the fact that he, like all of us, is human.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I think of Joseph Kennedy during the time just before World War II. He too, you know, and of course he was the patriarch of the Kennedy family. He too was isolationist and had his support for Nazi Germany at some point. So that was happening.
Yeah.
A little bit more, Jim, about the foundation and what exactly it's doing. I guess it's appropriate that what is going on in Africa through the foundation involves air flight of a sort, drones.
It does. The Lindbergh Foundation was hoping to have a new website up today. It didn't have it up at the time I put the web piece together, why it's not linked there, so I just linked to the foundation. They're working with a company in Africa that's already invested $2 million, has done 600 hours of flight, or 600 flights, 1,000 hours with drones with infrared cameras. And the key there is poachers like to work under the cover of darkness. The infrared pierces through that. They have such a high vantage point that they can see the human form in the night coming from a great distance away and alert rangers. Their success to this point, as Jim Peterson, the chairman of the Lindbergh Foundation, says, is that no animals, elephants or rhinoceroses, have been killed while the drones have been flying in areas where the drones have been flying because the word gets out and the poachers don't want to be anywhere around where the rangers may be. I have no way to independently verify that. I have no reason to doubt what he's telling me. But the foundation is trying to raise an additional $500,000 to put up to 7 drone teams in a number of countries in Africa to expand this effort based on Lindbergh's name and legacy and interest in the environment.
Interesting, Sharon. Interesting that it's taken that direction.
Yes, and you know that's the great thing about the Lindbergh Foundation is that they fund a lot of these efforts to look at conservation and the environment, and all of the folks who are busy thinking about those things are the ones that get the Lindbergh Foundation's attention. So that's great.
At some point, will those artifacts and the things that you have be back on display at the History Museum?
You know, yes. You know, in varying ways, we find ways to put at least some of those things in exhibits any chance we get. And like I mentioned with the 250 exhibit, which will close in a couple weeks, people will still get to see the flight suit. I think in the next couple years, if they stay tuned, they'll see Lindbergh in some upcoming exhibits. Maybe not in the ways that we've done before where it's just a Lindbergh exhibit, but certainly that story can't not be told when we do exhibits at the History Museum.
What's the most impressive piece you have?
Well, I was just talking a little bit ago that the flight suit is probably one of the most iconic mm-hmm. pieces. It's the piece that has been requested at the turn of the century as one of the iconic moments in the 20th century. People want to talk about Lindbergh. The flight suit is that sort of moment. If you have an artifact other than the Spirit of St. Louis, which we don't have in St. Louis, it's the flight suit because it was sort of on the flight and the embodiment of Charles Lindbergh himself. So, yeah.
Jim, we have less than a minute left. After all of your research on this subject, what is your takeaway? What is your impression and feeling about Charles Lindbergh now?
Well, he's a very human individual. I can't imagine at 25 doing that. There would have been a lot of youthful adrenaline involved, and it's something I would love to have experienced, but I'm also looking for a reason to go back to the museum in September and August, August or September, to see when the plane goes back up into the rafters. So maybe I'll get a second bite of this apple and we'll do another story.
How willing would you be to jump into that plane and fly it across the Atlantic?
Right now, in a heartbeat.
And you're no longer 25. I know that for a fact. Jim Howard, thanks. Go ahead.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. Again, on our website, stopublicradio.org, the online version of Jim's reporting is available as of this moment. Sharon Smith, thank you so much for being with us. Always great to take advantage of your knowledge about such things. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. It's been a pleasure.
And happy birthday, Charles Lindbergh. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at ways St. Louis County municipalities can cooperate but still retain their identities. Then we'll talk with Tavis Smiley about his new book examining Martin Luther King's final year of life. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.